Hello, everybody out there in podcast land, and welcome to the Front Row Network, the podcast for people who actually like movies. Today, we're bringing you another episode of Full Disclosure, and the hosts of the Front Row Flashbacks have taken it over, and we're giving you the Full Disclosure flashback style you all deserve and love. Today, we're digging into the award-winning and shoo-in Oscar contender, Promising Young Women. I'm Erin McCabe, and along with me are my flashback and female empowerment co-hosts, Ryan Lutens and Jay Hoffman. Jay, how's it going?
It's going great. I'm glad we're your female empowerment co-hosts.
I wouldn't know how to do female empowerment without you two. Ryan, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, and for my co-host to give me a whole bunch of my work, we're looking at Promising Woman, but you know, just potato, doing great.
I love how much that your microphone was skipping there because of your internet connection.
My is sucking one, so but this is not, you know, being right away. But funny that I always mess up words, and you know, Erin did it tonight, so it's just justification for me. I feel vindicated.
There is something neurolinguistically with this movie, because I keep wanting to call it Promising Young Women instead of Promising Young Woman. So I got to dig into that.
I'm glad I was able to make that joke. So
I think it's like a Little Women connection thing. You know, it's just, it's in the title. I don't know. Maybe not.
Yeah, I could see that. Jay, why don't you give us the rundown?
All right. Spoiler free.
Yes.
Cassandra, a struggling 30-something that works a menial job at a coffee shop, is secretly a Batwoman type for the Me Too movement. She researches and finds scummy dudes at bars preying on drunk women to take vengeance upon and set them on a better path moving forward. The event that has shaped her worldview haunts her throughout the film. Will she be able to contain her rage or turn into a vengeful version of the thing she hates?
Ooh, that's good. We'll get into it later, but yeah, this movie has got a lot of great questions and gray area. It makes you really think, and I love a movie like that.
Ray.
Oh my gosh, I'm really struggling. This movie did a number on me.
Welcome to the dark side.
Ryan, how about those fun facts? I think that's what really tripped me up, is usually I'm the fun facts. Ryan, okay, Ray.
I gotta do you justice. Should I sing it like Ray Charles? No, that'd be a slap in the face, because that man is a god. Fun facts. All right, this movie was written and directed in her first feature film by Emerald Fennell. It stars Carey Mulligan as Cassandra, Bo Burnham as Ryan, not Ray, Allison Brie as Madison, Laverne Cox as Gail, Clancy Brown the Kurgan as Stanley, Jennifer Coolidge as Susan, Connie Britton as Dean Walker, Sam Richardson as Paul, Christopher McLovin Mince Pies as Neil, Molly Shannon as Mrs. Fisher, Max Greenfield as Joe, Chris Lowell as Al Monroe, and Adam Brody in the first 5 minutes as Jerry. This movie, when it opened up in the U.S., it made $719,000. And then total gross for the U.S. was $5,397,000. And then worldwide, it went on to gross $9,421,000, which is huge. I love seeing those huge uptakes, especially for a movie as good as this. Rotten Tomato has a score of 90%. With the audience score at 87. So, you know, we're right in the thick of award seasons. So let's just break it down. Golden Globes were not too long ago. It was nominated for 4. Best Motion Picture Drama, Best Actress, Best Director, Best Screenplay. It won nothing, which is stupid. Screen Actors Guild Awards are going to be coming up. And Carey Mulligan is nominated for Best Actress in a Lead Role. Emerald Fennell also got nominated for the Directors Guild of America for Outstanding Directors. And the Critics' Choice Awards just happened not too long ago. It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Costume Design, and Best Makeup. It won none of those. However, it did win Best Screenplay, which is fantastic. And, of course, Carey Mulligan took home the award for Best Actress, which is huge for that race. But just basic facts, fun facts about the movie and the context of the movie. The title is a reference. Now, of course, these are non-spoilers. The title is a reference to Brock Turner, a Stanford University student who was convicted of sexual assault in 2016. Despite this conviction, many people referred to him as a promising young man. Upon scoring the lead role, Mulligan was sent a playlist by, from Emerald Fennell that would set the mood for the film. Toxic by Britney Spears was featured twice because Fennell is a self-declared Britney Spears superfan and considers the song to be the best of all time. At the same time, she wanted to rebel against the dismissive notion that female pop culture is a guilty pleasure and therefore made it an integral part of the audiovisual side of the film and provides, I'm going to include this, provides some of the most haunting violin solo of Toxic I've ever heard in my life that really set up the third act of the film. The word rape and sexual assault are not spoken in the film, which is huge. We'll get into that. There are multiple shots where Cassie is seated in front of her headboard with a white frame jutting out. So it symbolizes angel wings. That's for the viewer to decide. The song Once Upon a Time, There Was a Pretty Fly is from The Night of the Hunter, which was made in 1955, which is coincidentally featured in the film when Cassie sees her parents watching it in the middle part of the film. I just have to say this too. Paris Hilton made a comeback with her song Stars Are Blind in a featured part of the film. And it's kind of fun, but we'll talk about that. So those are your fun facts. Aaron, did I do you justice?
Ryan, you were me and everything more. So thank you. So before we get into the full disclosure and all the spoilers, let's do some spoiler-free initial first thoughts. Upon seeing this movie, Jay, what were your first impressions?
I really liked it. I, for being such heavy content, you know, I was kind of unsure what it was going to be like because very heavy content, but it is also a very exciting movie, a very suspenseful movie, but it to me took on like a superhero movie of sorts. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting. And then like after Ray went through some of the fun facts here, I think some of those facts are really, really interesting in what they add to the film. That last part about the song from Night of the Hunter, you know, Night of the Hunter is kind of one of the first serial killer movies that came out. It's about a man who's stalking women, you know, so very, very intentional, not using the word rape or sexuals. Like all those things mentioned were incredibly intentional and to me make for a more impactful film. I left the movie thinking about it a lot. And Aaron and I recorded Thelma and Louise like the same week that I saw this. So it was just like double whammy of some heavy issues in the realm of sexual assault and how it's dealt with. But this movie is just so damn suspenseful. And I think without Carey Mulligan, this is not the same movie. She is captivating and frightening, both in equal measures. She can be charming, she can be a train wreck, but when she goes into what I'll call like her superhero mode, dude, she's female Batman. Like she's scary. Mm-hmm. And she like knows exactly what to say, and she's very methodical, and man, I liked it a lot. And it's a movie that it has rewatchability. It's exciting. Yet you're going to be thinking about it for a really long time. I think this is going to be in the zeitgeist for a really long time. I think this movie is going to get referred to a lot.
Yeah. You had mentioned during Thelma and Louise that you felt like this was going to be this generation's Thelma and Louise.
Yeah. Although I will say, I've said it in that one too, and we'll put that in the show notes. We'll link up. We got to get a good shout out to our own show. So we'll put a link to Thelma and Louise. I thought they were going to be a lot more kind of spiritual sequels, but I don't, mm-hmm. I told you, I didn't think they were. I didn't think they were. I think this has a much darker turn, and I think it really digs way more into the psychology of what happens and what can happen and what what it does.
Definitely. Ryan, what about you? Your initial thoughts on Promising Young Woman?
Thank you for that.
It's here, Ray.
So Jay said this is definitely a movie you can watch twice. I did watch it twice from the time that I was able to view it. And just recently, just because it is such a good movie. And I remember when I did my initial research on this film, I heard it referenced as a horror film. And I thought, okay, this is right up my alley. This is not a horror movie. This is your definition textbook, a suspense thriller. And it is beautifully crafted by Emerald Fennell in her feature directorial debut. And, you know, she kills it. And she did this while pregnant. And they did it in 23 days and you this masterpiece. You just grow to appreciate the movie more when you do your research on it. But Emerald Fennell, I mean, she's had a banner year. She was Camilla Parker Bowles in the last season of The Crown. And then she goes around and then directs this movie, which she's getting all type of rave reviews for her writing and her directing, which is huge.
And she should.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic.
Oh, it's warranted.
I'm going to talk about the writing when we talk just the movie in general for spoiler scenes, because how she came up with the idea for the movie, because this is original screenplay. I mean, it just floored me when I read it. But yeah, just overall, this movie, Margot Robbie is a producer of this film, and everybody thought that this was going to be a Margot Robbie vehicle. And I think this movie would not have worked if it was Margot Robbie, because Carrie Mulligan brings a certain quality to this film that is just, you can't take your eyes off of her, because she is riveting, captivating, and frightening at the same time, because it's just, you think you know the story, but the story just completely turns on a heel. But we'll get into that. But yeah, overall, I mean, this movie is definitely going to be in my top five. I still have yet to see The Father. The Father is the movie that I am definitely pushing to see hard in terms of awards and best of. But yeah, this movie is definitely going to be in my top five, top 10 of 2020, 2021. So.
Awesome. Yeah, this movie was, I had never seen a trailer for it. You know, I heard about it because you guys were talking about it. And Jay was like, you should really watch it. Everyone knows I'm kind of sensitive to certain content. You know, you guys assured me it was going to be fine. And especially content that deals with physical, like, you know, with kind of like this sort of thing, I can get pretty squeamish about. But this movie is fantastic. Promising Young Woman does not waste a single frame of this entire film. It gives you so much to think about, but it's also a movie that doesn't spoon feed you everything that you're gonna think about in it. It's really, you definitely have to have the emotional and mental bandwidth available to sit and watch it. But when you're in it, I agree with you, Ryan. It's definitely a movie that I'll be watching twice, not just for the actual story, but the visual drama that Emerald Fennell creates in every frame. There's not a color. There's not a song. There's not a quadrant that's wasted in this film to enrich the story. And so I think that in and of itself, from a cinematic point of view, as you were saying in one of our Patreon reels, that, you know, these awards are all about art and what kind of art form film is. And this film is a work of cinematic art. And so I think that when we get into it, when we talk about acting, one of the things that I really enjoyed about this film is that it doesn't rely too heavily on, even though Carey Mulligan is amazing, it doesn't rely so heavily on her performance alone that it really creates a very rich experience in watching it.
Yeah. And one thing you said, I think that stands out to me, you know, you said you're sensitive to those things. I think this is clearly a movie about a topic that's sensitive, made by a woman. I think for some reason, a guy's in charge of a story like this. They're like, you got to put the scene in there. You gotta put the scene, you know, it's like, you don't need the scene at all to be effective.
We're starting to be spoilery.
This isn't spoilery. I think though it was with the intent that, hey, maybe a chunk of the audience has had these experiences, and I'm going to make something about that that's watchable, because it's much more, you know, it's a lot of the aftermath of things. So,
and done in good taste, but
Yeah, we can get into that during scenes too, because I did find that refreshing as well. So while we're getting into it, why don't we just go full into the spoilers? So for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, you know, take a pause, go watch it, come back, because we are going to give you the spoilers in 3, 2, 1.
Holy crap.
Carey Mulligan has a kill switch.
Okay. So what I meant by the spoilery is because Emerald Fennell leaves it all up to the viewer's mind. You know, they purposely never showed that, and they did it in good taste. They showed the audio, but that's it. Like, you are forming, you know, you're seeing that disgusting display. So let's dive.
You're just hearing this. I mean, yeah, we're getting into the favorite scenes. Let's start off with that one real quick. You know, what you find out in the film is that Carey Mulligan's character, Cassie, is struggling immensely, emotionally, mentally, after in college, her friend was sexually assaulted and not believed, and then eventually, correct me if I'm wrong, just takes her own life.
Yes.
The strife.
We don't know.
We don't really know exactly. We don't really know.
It's heavily implied.
But there are some weird things where I'm like, did it? But she's gone. She's not alive. And so what you also find out is that finally, it's revealed that this act that people were not believing Nina, her best friend, on, is filmed. And so what we're referring to is, in the movie, she gets a copy of the video of it. And you never actually, the audience never sees the video, which I agree. I found very refreshing, because I know that I've told you guys with certain, like, suspense or horror movies, where those genres started to lose me was when they needed to show me every single thing and left nothing to the imagination. There's something very effective about panning off screen, or about just giving the audio of something and exactly letting your own imagination fill in those gaps without forcing you to see it.
Yeah. Agree 100%. So the best part is, like, you know, I shouldn't say the best part, her character development. I mean, she is a complete roller coaster in this film, but I want to talk about how Emerald Fennell came up with the movie. That's one of the first scenes. So, Cassie, Carey Mulligan's character, it's almost like she is out there to prevent people from doing this. And, you know, the way that Emerald Fennell thought about this is, what if someone was drunk and they were about to, you know, someone was undressing them and they were very drunkenly say, what are you doing? And then the next moment, you know, as the, you know, clothes are coming off, they ask in a very sober tone, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And that's how Emerald Fennell completely wrote this thing. And that's that was the first victim, quote unquote. There, and the best part about victim is when she's leaving, there's what you think is blood, and it's just ketchup. But Cassie's whole thing is going out and basically, you know, taking men and dropping them down a peg, and because she's going out there and catching predators, and she's telling them that you need to stop this, and having them realize that, you know, these are people. And she fakes being drunk and then gets them home and just lays into them, and it's perfect.
And how they did that, right?
Yeah.
Because first of all, this movie is like littered with like people you would recognize from movies and sitcoms, like littered, and they're like bit players in this, which is amazing.
Yes.
But it starts you know, with Adam Brody. He's like the nice guy. He's giving her a ride home. And he's playing the role
he's played in every other movie or show.
He turns into a scumbag.
My apartment's right here. Do you want to stop by for a drink? And she's acting like she's drunk.
Yeah, she's playing him. But with that one, right, we don't necessarily see how it ends.
Right.
I don't think she's a killer.
Right. We don't see how it ends. But the way it's done, right, we don't see how it ends. Until you get to McLovin, who actually, by the way, is great in this.
Yes.
You know, he's really shed.
Feel the coke addict.
Yeah, he's definitely shed the McLovin image. You know, he's mainly, I think, kind of a voice actor now with How to Train Your Dragon and all that. But he's actually really, really good in this. But that's where we see what she's doing. And she's just scaring the ever-living dog shit out of him.
Yeah.
To the point where she goes, be better. And then she marks it off, and you're like, oh, that's why I was like, she's Batman. She's got like this code. She's, you know, this is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to do it. It's very methodical. She knows exactly.
Right.
We know Jerry's alive later on in the film because she does it again. And when her ruse is busted, and we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah.
But when her ruse is busted, the guy goes, you're the girl that Jerry was talking about. But then she turned it on him again and said, there's more of us out there.
Right.
You know, and she's like, one of them carries scissors.
And that was
sparking fear.
And that guy was Sam Richardson, who's on Veep. And he's just another one of those, like, I know that guy. And like, man, I can't believe how littered with that's why I like when I was putting all the actors, I'm like, oh, there's so many actors, you know. Just that's a whole other thing, but it was amazing.
Okay, so what I'm going to say, I know we're still in scenes. I'll say it when we get to actors. We'll stick with the scenes because I think she, like the layers of Emerald Fennell's genius in this film, from casting to scenes to everything, it's like an onion. Like you could unpeel this all day, really and truly. So I'll get to that in acting. But those scenes too are really like that first one. It's very interesting, that opening scene comes hard out the gate with Jerry or Adam Brody's two friends saying the very stereotypical, like, crappy guy things, you know, about a drunk girl, right? Like, ah, she's asking for it and this. And he's like, got, you know, kind of like, oh, I'll see if she's okay. And he's kind of playing this, like, I'm like, oh, yeah, chivalrous, like, good for him, you know?
Nope.
And I'm still, okay, this is my problem. This is why my husband's like, you're too naive. I'm still like, what a good guy, right? All the way until he gets into the apartment. And then I see how big the drink he pours for her. And I'm like, oh God, my gut hurt. I was like, oh, I've been duped again. This is good. But it's true. Like they do such, it's a lot of gut punches too in this movie. I think as a woman, really like is. When you're watching it, where you're like, ooh, I've been in this situation before. Even if it didn't end poorly, there were maybe some intentions or, you know, impulses behind some of it, but like you can really recognize in some of these scenes, like when they're going, like they're keep telling her how beautiful she is. I had a moment where I was like, am I not as cute as I thought I was in college? Like to my husband, like am I not as pretty, you know, like what's going on? I thought I was just like, I thought I was pretty cute. Maybe I wasn't as cute as I thought. After, because they're constantly like just kind of feeding her like BS and lines and stuff. So that was super interesting.
Yeah. Can I talk about a scene?
Oh yes, I know. You're chomping at the bit.
Okay. Cause I've got two that I want to talk about.
Do it. Do it, Ryan. Get to your
scene. So Nina is not around for obvious reasons. Or do we? Anyway. But the person that took advantage of Nina is named Al. And, you know, Cassie put him out of her mind, and she was just doing this as like a memory for Nina, you know, because she doesn't want it to happen to anybody else. But then when Al enters the picture, I think that's where Jay was getting to her vengeful spirit. Like, she was just out to do this now, just to bring pain and hurt that she had felt because of her friend, the things that her friend went to. And I'm telling you, the scene in the admissions office with the dean, played by Connie Britton, that is some of the most intense, beautifully acted. I mean, it's flawless. It is utterly flawless. It just oozes every emotion that you can think of with Cassandra just being who she is. So to set that up, Cassandra act like she was a hairdresser for this famous band, and she was outside of a high school asking for directions. She knew who she was looking for. She picked somebody up who happened to be a fan of that band, and that person happened to be the dean's daughter. And what ensued was just beautifully crafted, beautifully written, beautifully acted. It was so suspenseful. I mean, I just, what are your guys' thoughts? Because I'm muddled.
That scene was super intense. And so what I noticed in some of the other scenes, Fennell used more of a, an outside of the conversation, like over the shoulder shot, to where you're almost just watching, like you're just a spectator watching it. In that scene, it's a lot of shot reverse shot, like Coen Brothers style. And so it's very, very intense because like you're like in the middle of their ping ponging about this very intense subject. So it was super well done. You felt the tension of the dean in the position that she was in, and then Carrie, obviously, or Cassie trying to make her points. And then when it got really suspenseful, when she started being like, oh, well, I brought your daughter to the dorm room that happened in, and how that the tension shifted even harder into like fourth gear. It was like, it's a great scene. It's really powerful.
I don't want to give too much away, but that's exactly what she does. But there's other things that are said too. It's mm-hmm. just, and why she's targeting the dean. It's just crazy. But like you just, the acting in that scene, and they didn't rehearse either. When I was watching that video that I posted to you guys, but the screenplay, they talked to Emerald Fennell and Carey Mulligan, but they didn't have any time to really, you know, block it or rehearse. They just went for it, and holy crap. But I don't want to spoil it too much because it is a very key scene. So, and it's definitely like the tipping point for Cassie's character.
I think the other thing that scene does, because to me it feels like this movie was aimed at deconstructing some of the root cause. Like I felt like this was like a root cause analysis, and I thought that the dean represented the institutional or administrative hurdles involved with these situations, you know, by giving the dean's perspective and how she has to approach these. So I thought it was really interesting from that perspective as well, when you look at the overall deconstruction. And because we'll get into this, you know, we mentioned in the fun facts, they never once mentioned the word rape or sexual assault. I think there's several reasons for that. One is, you know, everybody was tiptoeing around the subject, so they didn't say it. But I also mm-hmm. think by kind of taking a root cause analysis approach to the topic, it's saying this is the end result of this and this and this, right? These things kind of culminate and create this thing. So we'll get into that maybe a little later with hopefully some debate. That's what I really liked in the scene, is it represented of that administrative hurdle aspect to these issues.
There are some really powerful scenes that wade you into the complexities of this kind of situation and the ripple effect it causes. And it gives you, I wouldn't say that everything is super black and white. I think there is a lot of gray, and I think it's represented in a really nuanced way that that's what I love about all of these scenes in this movie is that you kind of, at least for me, I walk away from it being like, ooh, I had a little bit too much to think last night, you know, and wanting to go back to it and like, you know, really getting into it and looking and seeing it. And I agree. I think that there are several scenes and characters that represent a bigger, bigger like portion of the subject.
Well, Aaron, like you were just saying, like the ripple effect. After that scene in the admissions office, she is in her car and she's processing. She's really processing what she just did and who she's becoming.
Yeah.
And some moron is behind her honking his horn, like, you know, has no idea what she's going through. And sure. He drives up and just insults her and she snaps. And I thought that was a beautiful scene too, because it really encapsulate her inner struggle.
You know, that scene I really liked. And talk about another big name who was a bit player is the one with Alfred Molina, who was in this movie.
Yeah.
Because he's hardly in. It is crazy. There's like so many names that you would recognize.
And his scene too, super intense.
And I thought that represented another aspect, right?
Absolutely.
I think it was good commentary on this kind of state of affairs I think we find ourselves in now where like, there's no realm of forgiveness for things.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong. There's like things in this movie that maybe people don't want to ever forgive, but that scene represented what's it take? What's it take to truly be remorseful, to change, to find the error of your ways. And he was the lawyer who represented Al got it all taken care of, no problem. And that was kind of his shtick. Slimeball lawyer that gets rich white dudes off of sexual assault and rape charges. Like sure. That was his shtick. And he was a broken man because of it. He was utterly remorseful. He lived his life in grief. And he has this just tremendous breakdown, just begging for her forgiveness. And he was on her list, right? He was one. She didn't go there to get forgiveness. She went there for punishment. She went there for vengeance.
For sure.
And he changed her. And I think he changed her mind on that one.
Yeah.
And I think that showed she was a conflicted character. Right. She seems so self-assured in her mission and her task the whole movie. And then it, like Ryan said, you know, you got the dean, you got that, these little scenes sprinkled throughout. And that one was a big one for me. The other scene that I really liked was like, not quite the scene at the end where she goes in and pretends to be the nurse stripper, the lead up to that scene, the lead up right up till she knocks on the door. She's getting her hair a certain way. She's doing her makeup a certain way. Like everything's like, to me, that she's putting on her uniform. She was putting on her cape and cowl.
It's very ritualistic.
Yeah. Because she was a different person when she'd put her smeared makeup on and go to the bar. She was a different person than she was at work.
Yeah.
It's like, as soon as all that goes on, it's boom. She's in the character she wants to be.
You know, when she's getting ready for the bar, it's, hey, it's time to teach somebody a lesson. When she was getting ready to go into Al's bachelor party, she was going for justice. And she was.
And that's that violin.
Yep.
Whew. Good. I was like, whoa,
so good.
Oh, it's giving me the chills.
And it's a awesome, awesome use of costuming in the whole entire film of when she's in her parents' house and when she's with her boyfriend, as she develops a relationship with, she's wearing pink, soft pinks, very innocent like clothing, a lot of florals, small fruits, and she's always in clothing that kind of represents like the innocent side that she's either trying to portray or she's trying to put out there. And obviously the stark contrast of when she's out doing her thing and in that other persona, that Batwoman-esque, Batman-esque persona. Very, very stark difference. And I thought that was so, so clever just to even use that.
Look at the symbolism of what she was when she was pretending to be a stripper. She was a nurse. Everything that took her past, they were in med school. And then the event happened and they dropped out. Whereas the people that were still in went on to be doctors. They're all doctors. So I think that was a huge, huge key symbolism right there, is that they were playing into their vanity.
Oh, really? See, I took that as like, oh my God, if I got money for every time I got, you know, asked about, like, for Halloween, like a sexy nurse costume.
Well, there's that too.
Oh my gosh. You know, I felt like that was, and maybe it was like double play, but, you know, oh my gosh, every Halloween costume, right? Like the sexy this and the sexy that. And it's like, oh, kill me, kill me.
This year's hot one, the sexy RGB. What?
there's a costume like there that definitely out there for is. Sure. Yeah. For sure. So,
well, I think it also is like, past has come back to haunt you, you know, not just like that too.
And I know this was produced by Margot Robbie, but that scene where she dresses up as the nurse, like, tell me that did not definitely have
Harley Quinn vibes.
Harley Quinn, but also Joker vibes. Mm-hmm. This movie had a little bit of Joker vibes to it too, I thought. And I thought that added to it.
For sure. You didn't know what she was going to do. But that was part of the suspense, right? Like, what is she? Is she gonna cut this guy's stuff off? What's she gonna do?
Right, like, what did she do to the dean's daughter? Like, how sadistic is this getting?
What
does
she do? What is? Yeah, you don't quite know, and it builds. But you know why I think, and I don't know. Aaron, did you give us some of your favorite scenes?
You know, I'll throw this because I think we really want to talk about that ending scene altogether. But one of my favorite scenes that I think opens up some questions too is the scene where after Cassie kind of forgives the defense lawyer, she goes to Nina's mom's house, Nina's house, and is sitting there kind of rehashing some things. And her mom,
Molly Shannon.
So they just use, they, we'll get into this with acting, but she is sitting there like, what are you doing here? Why are you not moving on? This is unhealthy. And that was really interesting because there is definitely tiptoeing. Like, her parents don't know what's going on.
Well, and her parents at one point at the end, they said that she's not all there.
Right. Like, they don't understand, but I even feel like they don't maybe understand the full extent of what maybe even happened in college with Cassie or how it affected her. But then this scene where she's talking like Nina's mother, there's some interesting like questions about coping. I think this scene brings up because you've got Nina's mother who's, you know, her daughter died. She experienced this tragic sexual assault that ends up maybe potentially, we think, leading to her death. And she's in a much better place mentally than her best friend is. And is kind of coaxing her like, you've got to move on. You've got to give this up. You're acting like a child. So I just thought that scene was really interesting. What did you guys kind of take away from that, of what it meant to her character? Like, what it, I don't know.
I
that one's got me a little perplexed.
And this is what I'm going to say. Do you notice that we never see an adult picture of Nina? It's always when they're younger. So she's always trying to go back on, you know, the kid life, or, you know, you never see a picture of Nina. So she's trying to hang on to that innocence. And so that by going to Molly Shannon's character, Nina's mom, you know, she'll invite, you know, it's a part of her daughter's life, but she's like, you need to, like, we can still be friends, but this harping on it is, it's just, it's not good. Like, you definitely get those undertones when Molly Shannon is speaking to her, especially the last thing she says when she walks into the house before, you know, she leaves Cassie sitting on the stairs is, let it go. Like, the mother is saying that.
Right.
I think you're right, Ryan, about holding on to innocence. I also think, you know, this movie has such good commentary, good social commentary.
Yes.
And I think this ties into the end and why it's a troubling end, because it's like, I kind of want this end, but I kind of don't, you know, it's a troubling end, right, to deal with. And I think it's commentary on, I think, our society's views on justice and punishment, and how we're a society that prefers vengeance to justice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have what we call corrections facilities, but everybody wants them treated like dirt. Like, why is it called, what are we correct? Are we correcting? Or are we treating
There's
them like
no
dirt?
Rehabilitation.
Like, that's a whole other discussion, you know, right. Are they actually doing that? But, you know, I think there's commentary there. Is it better to have revenge? Is it better to exact a violent act back onto somebody who committed a violent act? Is it better to rehabilitate yourself, rehabilitate them? What's the better route moving forward? And it's a simple commentary, because I think we're going to be dealing with that as a society at large for a long time. But I think that scene does a really good job of that commentary too.
Mm.
Before we hop into the talking about the end, can I just hop in with my other favorite scene? Because it goes into what you said about her development.
Do it, Ray.
Cassie's not, like, you definitely see her go through a whole range of emotions in this film. And at one point, there is a highlight, and the movie highlights that. Like, you know, it's like she's on the way up, and they do it with them lip syncing and even singing Stars Are Blind by Paris Hilton in a pharmacy. Like, you see her become happy again. Like, maybe there is going to be a happy ending for her. And you feel that
she's trusting in a man. She's in a seemingly healthy Ryan. Relationship.
You know, she met Ryan or Ray, whichever. And she spit in his coffee the first time they met. You know, at that point you're rooting for her, you know. You know, she's a take no prisoner, you know, she stands up for, like, she's awesome. You know, but then she lets Ryan in, and when that happens, they start singing, and Stars Are Blind, and you have this huge montage of how happy her life is. But then Allison Brie, who's someone she blackmailed in one of her plots, brings the video up. Now, we never see the video, but in the video, she hears Ryan's voice. Ryan was present.
You feel
that with her, too. It's so bad.
Yeah,
that's when she starts to spiral and we get to the ending. So
that was absolutely soul crushing.
It was awful, because she was so happy and you wanted her to be happy. It's like, you did good by teaching these men, you taught them a lesson, you can have happiness, and then crap.
Well, and I think that leads to, also before the ending scene, another really powerful scene where you've gotten to know this character. They're 7 years away from this event. So when this happened, they were in college. They were 23 or however old, you know, 22. And you've gotten to know this person. He has clearly, like, the character you get to know seems like a pretty good guy. He's been respectful. They've got a good relationship. He's clearly grown, but then you find out that he has participated in a grave mistake 7 years prior. Now, not only does this shatter, you know, her perception of him, this is obviously a terrible, you know, this event ruined her life as well. But then it gets to the scene where she calls him out on it, and he's kind of going through the, like, she's like, I could ruin your life with this. And he's like, you know, he would lose everything. And he's kind of doing the whole, like, I didn't actually do it, but he didn't call it out. He didn't stop it. He didn't come forward. You know, he was an active bystander in this. Yeah. So, like, back to what you were saying, Jay, about how we're also in a place in society where we've made it extremely difficult to be forgiven about past things. I think that's one of those that it was a good, where it makes you think and you're going, okay, does this guy who's now contributing positively to society, has seems to be very respectful to women, made a terrible mistake 7 years prior. What happens to someone like that? Because one of the things we run into in like, I think that's part of the issue why no one ever wants to come forward is also the, well, my life's going to get ruined. And we kind of see that in the hospital in the terms of people admitting mistakes when there were punitive things always attached to punitive consequences, always attached to any sort of mistake. They found, you know, just statistically less people came forward with things that went wrong. And so we were never able to really correct things from like a healthcare standpoint to make patient safety better or stuff like that. So I think there's something to be said there about when someone does come forward or someone does make a mistake or someone does admit to something they did however many years ago, how are they treated and how are they able to still like live their life? And especially now with like cancel culture and stuff, like that makes it even more difficult. So I thought that was super powerful scene where he kind of like, he did kind of backtrack on his own morals and ethics of all of a sudden being like, well, I can't ruin my, like he went into self-preservation mode.
Yeah.
I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
She blackmailed him. She blackmailed him hard. Give me the location of Al's bachelor party or else.
Yeah.
She had completely flipped the script. She went back to her sociopath ways. And this is someone that she said that she was starting to fall in love with. It's just like the range of emotions that Carey Mulligan can do with having a straight face.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll talk about that with.
But him too. He flipped right into self-preservation. He was like, I mean, he on a dime. They both did.
Yeah, but I mean, she gets the location and she goes. So let's talk. Let's talk final scene.
Oh my God, so intense.
So she's brilliant. Like her the way she thinks things through. Like she would have been an amazing doctor, but. She had a backup plan in case anything happened to her, and it did. She was getting ready to carve Nina's name into Al's chest after she drugged the entire basement full of partygoers. She was going to have her way with Al and, you know, carve him up. Al gets free, and he suffocates her, puts a pillow over her head and suffocates her. And Emerald Fennell and Carey Mulligan went to a doctor and asked how long, or a police officer, and asked how long does it take to suffocate someone with a pillow? And they said 2 minutes and 5 seconds. That's how long the scene is. Mm-hmm. And it is tough to watch because you hear her screaming. I believe she had to go on and do some like ADR thing where she had just screamed into a microphone, but it's tough to watch. But she is killed. And Joe, a.k.a. Schmidt from New Girl, again, casting, comes up to save Al, and they get rid of the body. And she's wearing a Nina necklace. And then you find out everything kind of unfolds. You know, she sent something to the lawyer. She sent the phone, so that way there's the proof is out there. She left her necklace that had her name in the drawer of the coffee shop. And... Al gets arrested. That's it. That's all you know. And the best part about it, when Al's getting arrested, the person that was his accomplice takes off running in the other direction. And lastly, you see Ryan just standing there getting scheduled messages from Cassie saying it's not over, but it is now. And then she signs it, Cassie and Nina. I thought, what a powerful way to end a movie, leave it completely ambiguous, but not. So I don't know.
And the video was sent to Alfred Molina.
Right. The phone.
Here's the thing. I had a different interpretation of the ending than you. Yeah. You said that was her plan B?
No, that was plan A. That was plan A.
I don't know.
Oh, you thought she walked into it knowing she was going to get killed?
I don't think she had any intention of actually carving him up.
Really?
Really.
You think that she loosened didn't put him on right?
Yes.
To die?
I thought her intention was to die.
Wow.
I thought that too, But I also thought that this, you know, she was, I don't know, that's a solid call. Because that thought did cross my mind, but a part of me was like,
at first I didn't. At first I was like, oh God, this went wrong. And then the ending happened. And I was like, God, it was her plan the whole time.
I think that she was essentially committing suicide to be with Nina. But a part of me too is that vengeful spirit. Like she wanted to continue on and let Al live with this whole thing. Yeah, and I think she was willing to go to prison for that. It's all interpretation. You can see it.
I think you're right. I think she wanted to punish everybody. Man, she turned into Ghost Rider at that point.
Yes.
Yeah.
including Ryan. Right.
Not Ray.
Not Ryan, Ray. Her boyfriend, ex-boyfriend in the movie. I think that's why I think the death was what she wanted. I think that was going to weigh on everybody at the party, everybody that participated. So to me, I thought that was the plan the whole time. Like I said, you don't at first, I just thought it went horribly wrong. I was like, gosh, she screwed this up so bad. How? She's been not screwing literally anything up this whole movie. And then you're like, oh man, she is the Joker.
Yeah. I mean,
she is an agent of vengeful chaos.
The movie is so well written that it literally allows for you to look at both of these and they're both credible. Because the note that she left Alfred Molina, the lawyer, it said, in case of my disappearance. But then again, it very well could have been a planned suicide where she had the handcuffs not on all the way. But he was going at him for like a while. So that's where I think this wasn't planned, because he was locked up. Unless there was a failsafe. I don't know. Again, completely ambiguous and allows the viewer to completely make their own assertion.
Yeah, she could have known, or she could have just realized that her recklessness was going to eventually lead to her demise. I will say this, if I'm going to nitpick anything, I thought it was funny that they burned the body and the only thing left was her cheap necklace. I'm like, that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, the temperature you'd have to get a fire to burn bone and everything is probably amazingly high. I will say they're doctors, so maybe they work with crematoriums or something. I don't know.
I think the only material that doesn't burn down in that sort of temperature where you're actually burning bones completely like that is like tungsten, because it has to reach like 6,000 degrees to burn tungsten. Because I always make fun of my husband because he has a tungsten wedding band, and I'm like, so if you die and all your bones are gone, like, I'm just going to have a ring and a pile of ashes. And I'm like, this was my husband.
To be fair, Schmidt was the one who threw the necklace in. So it probably wasn't a good throw anyway.
He threw it in. Yeah. That might change things.
So it landed by the riverside, not directly in the fire, because remember, her hand was out of the fire and he had to kick it in.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll retract my statement. Yeah, that ending scene, I could see that. How bad did you feel for her parents?
Well, let's get into acting, because I want to talk about Mr. Clancy Brown.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because I actually think he gave a very subdued, very good performance.
How was he not nominated for Best Supporting Actor for this?
Yeah, I thought he was really good. And you know, we just got done on flashbacks. Probably inappropriate to put a Highlander link in the show notes for this movie. But we just talked about him as the Kurgan in the Highlander. Totally different role. And he usually is like this big, scary, deep voice guy. You know, it's kind of his shtick. And he was like a broken, sad dad.
Like a kitten.
He was. And Jennifer Coolidge, a.k.a. Stifler's mom was good in it, but really Clancy Brown was just like,
they were defeated.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to help their daughter.
They were both really good, but he really stood out to me. Just like, he was just broken, man. And he didn't know how to help her. He didn't know what to do. And cause she was always just difficult at home, and they couldn't, you mentioned it earlier, they couldn't quite figure out exactly what was going on. She maybe didn't give them all the details, but she was acting
just knew that Nina was dead and Nina was close to her. They probably didn't know anything surrounding what happened in college. I don't know, but like, they were trying to be helpful and saying, hey, move out. Here's some luggage. But when she's talking to the police officer, like she's not, he even said she wasn't there mentally. You know, he knew that there was something wrong.
Aaron.
I was just going to say, I think that my interpretation of the level of her grief surrounding her friend's death and the unfortunate and the circumstances surrounding what led up to it was problematic. And I think we're also shown that through multiple lenses, not only just like her getting vengeance, but with Nina's mom and kind of with her own parents of, you know, maybe she wasn't talking about her level of grief or whatever was going on either, like probably also added to what I would consider a maladaptive coping mechanism.
Yeah.
So of the bit roles, right? Cause you've got Carey Mulligan, Bo Burnham, and maybe you could throw Alison Brie as like kind of the people who have a lot of screen time, but
right.
A lot of bit players who really do a great job. You know, Alfred Molina, great in his short scene. Connie Britton, great in her scene. Of the smaller players, who is like the standout for you guys? Like I said, I think for me, it's probably Alfred Molina and Clancy Brown.
I think McLovin is the cocaine, you know, because he literally he's trying to get her to snort cocaine. Like, you know, she's drunk and you're trying to take advantage of her, but now you're trying to get her to do hard drugs.
Well, yeah, dude, he wanted her to stay awake for it.
Right. But like, then
stay awake.
When he becomes
so at least he wanted her to be conscious.
Right. When he becomes an official tick and she, you know, turns it back on him, that was probably like the best, you know, teachable moment. I don't even know when she teaches him a lesson and he's like, what's my name? He has no idea. None.
Know nothing about her.
Nothing about her. And he's like beautifully acted. But I also want to say Bo Burnham, you know, he directed Eighth Grade last year. He was very subtle in his performance. Like you wanted to believe that he was a nice guy. You started to believe that he was a nice guy, and then it just completely turns on you. So, I mean, he was a very subtle, nuanced performance. So,
well, and if you're familiar with his comedy, he's like an absurdist comic. So like if you know him from his comedy and then very see him subtle, in this, it's like really, really good. Cause it's just like, he's a true absurdist with his humor. Yeah.
This movie is so well acted. Like, I think it's complete bullshit that this movie did not get a best ensemble for a Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah, it's a big year for that, but I agree. Aaron, what about you?
I love them all. What I love about the acting, I love Clancy. I think it's so funny I think it's all intentional. I mean, I don't think that I think everything that Emerald Fennell did in this movie is meticulous and intentional. And I think the casting was as well. Everyone in these roles it's a juxtaposition for what they normally play. So you've got Clancy Brown, who is a kitten in this movie. You've got Stifler's mom playing a like super kind of timid, you know, moderate woman. You've got, like you're saying, the guy who played Ryan,
Bo Burnham
who's usually kind of off the wall and wacky, playing this like more serious character. Carey Mulligan, to me, the roles that I know her in are usually very mousy and meek. And this is a complete juxtaposition from those roles. So I love that they did that with the bit players too. I think maybe with the exception of like Alfred Molina kind of, but like I loved that they used Adam Brody and McLovin as like weasels. As weasels. I do. I love that because they've always played, you know, those nice guys, like doormat kind of guys. So I loved that they did this with all of these different kind of roles. Even, what's his name? Joe, the guy from Max Greenfield, who's in
New Girl.
New Girl.
Yeah. Total opposite.
He was a super, Totally opposite of Schmidt. So, yeah. and I think that was all intentional.
Yeah, I think you're right. Allison Brie too. You know, yep. She's usually like sweet,
sweet, kind of naive, and
now,
like
now she's like, I don't know,
yep,
middle-aged grumpy one.
Her, you know what? I'll say this though about Allison Brie's role. It was a little reminiscent of her role in Mad Men.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Like as yeah.
I know her from. I'm thinking Community and Glow for her.
Yeah, where she's like really naive and bubbly and just kind of like yes. It was everyone was great in this movie. But that's what I enjoyed the most about the acting in general.
I think the thing you said with Carey Mulligan too, I think is what made this really, really work, because like in my brain, 7 years ago when all this went down, she was the Carey Mulligan from all the movies we know her in.
Yep. And it's like I told Jay, or I might have told you guys.
Morphed into this.
I have never rooted so much for a bad guy and then felt bad about it. It just, you feel for her and then you're just like, oh, frick, should I be cheering for her? Like, I don't know, because.
Oh, man, I feel like maybe you need to watch Uncut Gems.
I probably should.
That'll do that to you too.
By the way, Pee Wee Herman reached out to those directors to make a dark Pee Wee Herman movie, not related to this movie, but just
why not? We're here for it. Why not?
What a perfect segue to talk about award contention.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, Ryan, since this is your shtick, I want you to take it away with awards. What do you think this movie? Obviously, you've got some feelings about what you think it should be walking away with, but when we've got some of the other ones coming up, what do you think? What are your feelings?
Real quick, Oscars have not been announced yet.
No, so yeah, that's Monday.
This may come out after that.
Right, and you guys can see how good I am. This movie will probably be nominated for Best Directing, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Actress. Those are my three that it's going to happen. I'm of a mind to think that these three could take it. You know, it's definitely in there. You know, the Critics' Choice Award, they won Best Actress and Best Screenplay. Emerald Fennell is fantastic in terms of her direction, the way she frames shots, like when she's having the conversation with Alfred Molina, they are both center in a broad angle, and it is framed beautifully. You could cut the tension with how she has framed stuff in this film. But original screenplay, I mean, this movie was shot in 23 days and came out of her mind. And, you know, it's wild. But yeah, those three are the ones that it's definitely going to get nominated for. If the Academy does more than 10, you know, or does the 10 nominations, I think it is going to get nominated for Best Picture, or at least that's what I'm pulling for, because it is definitely one of my top 10 for sure. But yeah, Carey Mulligan, I think this is her year. You know, I've seen Ma Rainey, I've seen Nomadland, I've seen Pieces of a Woman. So those are the other three that are huge. I don't know who that four spot's going to, but I think Carey Mulligan is going to put this one in the bag for sure.
Yeah, I can't. It'll be very upsetting if this doesn't get nominated for Best Picture. I do think this is a year where the movies tend to have more influence, or I'm not sure what the word I'm looking for is, but more social commentary on the things of the world. And this movie falls well into that, you know, with good Lord, Judas and the Black Messiah. There we go. Trial of Chicago 7, you know,
Nomadland,
Miami. We're not going to talk about Nomadland right now.
Why?
There's an ongoing argument about
no. So we have all those things going. Then there's the movie where somebody takes a dump in a bucket in a van, which is a good, pretty good quick review of Nomadland.
Or listen to
there's
me in
your
jail.
Full disclosure on Nomadland.
But I think this falls into that, you know, which I like. You know, we had a debate the other day on what should awards for movies look like, and my argument is something that technically or in some way advances the film industry or has some sort of influence or powerful commentary on social happenings of the world, and it falls into definitely the social happenings. I think from a storytelling perspective too, it's different, right? This was a movie about grief, about sexual assault, yet it felt framed like a superhero movie, you know, like it was really, it was really interesting, really, like all of it's really, really interesting. I think this is a movie of all the movies though that we're talking about. I think this one, Judas and the Black Messiah, I think those are the two movies that we're talking in the prestige stuff that we're going to be talking about for 20 years. I'm not so sure about some of the others.
We haven't seen The Father yet. I'm plugging hard for that movie.
We know. I just don't see a movie about dementia being one that we, I think it'll be good, but I don't think it's one we're going to be talking about for.
I think it's a performance piece. I don't know.
And that's fine. I just don't think performance pieces are those movies we talk about at length. Mm-hmm. I think it's the movies like this with that social commentary. I think, and one that's probably now not somehow going to get nominated because it came out too early in the year. What? That doesn't even make sense. The Five Bloods is one that also should 100% be in the discussion. But there's a lot of movies last year that came out and at a very impactful time in society. And so I hope it gets a Best Picture nomination.
I'm hoping so too. I don't think Emerald Fennell is going to win for directing, but I hope they split it and give, because I think we'll talk Nomadland, but I think that might take director, and I hope they give her Best Original Screenplay because Sorkin's got an Oscar already. So,
yeah, and of all these movies that we're talking, I think, yeah, this, Mank, and Judas and the Black Messiah are like my three favorite for sure.
Aaron, what are your thoughts?
I think, like I said to you guys in the chat before, I think this combo of Emerald Fennell and Benjamin Krakoun for cinematography are a dynamite combo in what they create in a cinematic experience and an art form in this film. I would love to see her win for Best Director. I would hands down love to see that. I feel like this film might get dicey for Best Picture because I think what this film does where it almost it's kind of ethically flexible. And I think that was like Hustler's problem. Yeah. We were real upset last year that Hustlers didn't make it. You know what I mean? And I think that's kind of the same thing where it's like, and we'll talk about this in the next section, but I don't know. I think this one kind of it's too ethically gray, I think, for some, where it's for Best Picture, I just almost don't see it happening. But I'd love to see Carey Mulligan win. I'd love to see Best Original Screenplay. I'd love to see Best Director. Any of those would be wonderful. This film definitely deserves accolades, that's for sure. Because it's just unbelievable how they get into all of the different facets and aspects of such a heavy and dense topic in a way that doesn't feel like you're being spoon-fed and like you're being taught like, okay, these are the talking points about sexual assault and these are all of the problems and these are all of the difficulties and these are all of the obstacles, and it does it and it puts it together in such a way that, again, like we talked about, you've got to really sit and think about it and think about the complexities. And there's something to be said about that.
Yeah. I think you said it's too ethically gray, which I think is fancy talk for it's not Oscar baity enough.
You think so?
That's
100%. It's not, this is not look like it doesn't follow the structure that they want is what I think. And I think they do. They like this nice, easily understandable, easily relatable,
palatable.
Yep. I don't think that's why I think we've had a lot of softballs the last couple decades in the Best Picture category, instead of movies that are challenging.
I'm
challenging in a good way, not challenging in like a Nomadland way.
I'm over here still dealing with my grief of Jennifer Lopez not getting an Oscar nomination.
I know. She was
hands down the best actress last year. And she wasn't even nominated.
I'm still mad we haven't actually talked about Hustlers as a film.
You know, when we did, when Brandon and I did the best actress category last year, we spent more time talking about J-Lo, who was not nominated, than we did any of the other actresses.
Yeah. Well, maybe Hustlers will be vindicated through a promising young woman. So let's get into, since we're talking about being ethically gray, unless anyone else has got anything about awards, but let's talk about the debate we were having. Was Cassie a hero? Was she an anti-hero, or was she a villain? And where do her actions place her on this continuum or this scale? Jay.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's good. I'm glad I started with you. No, I'm just kidding.
So perfect.
Man, we're doing well here.
Yeah.
I think generally an anti-hero, but I right, like if this were called The Punisher, we'd be like, hell yeah, anti-hero. But this movie is like not based in a fantastical world, right? It's based really and solidly and firmly in our world that we exist in, that we live in. And I think that's what makes it different, right? I think we can, it's easy to say anti-hero in a more fantastical world than it is a real world. So I personally think that her grief and her want for revenge turned her into the thing she hated. I think she, for most of the movie, she was an anti-hero. I think her approach was she had rules. She had kind of a moral code that she followed and how she was doing these things and always a plan. But I think it was the second where she found out, you know, Ryan was at the event. She had the issue with Dean and it just kind of compiled and it snapped. It went too far. And she was no longer able to maintain her moral compass that she was following. So I don't know if that makes her a villain, but I think it makes her a failed hero, if that makes sense. I don't think she was an outright villain by the end, right?
But yeah, I think seeing that visual of her friend in that position just flipped a switch on her.
Yeah. And it's weird to say that because, like, saying she's a villain, she was smothered to death with the pillow, but there was all intention of not it was beyond getting justice. It was beyond justice, right? So
yeah.
I think she's a failed hero because she became a person she didn't want to be more than she already was.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a non-answer.
Great. That's what I'm here. I love all the non-answers. Ryan, what's your non-answer?
I got a non-answer for you. She was a vigilante. You know, she was.
I thought that kind of too.
She was doing the right. She was doing something good, but in a negative way. Mm. She had to make her own justice. And, you know, you look at her book. You constantly see close-ups of her book. She keeps track of the people that she teaches a lesson to. And there are numerous. Mm-hmm. You know, she's doing something positive, but she's not going the proper way of doing it. It's again, gray. It's, you know, but I think seeing the video snap something in her and she, again, it's all about how you take the ending because the ending is very, it's all interpretive. You know, did she do this on purpose or was she going there to do something bad? So, or did she want to die? So yeah, I'm just going to say vigilante and just go from there because I don't have, you know, this is a movie that's going to constantly make me think about this for quite some time.
No, I thought about that too, in the sense of when we were talking about what was she, and like, you know, again, it's like even me myself thinking about like my own moral or ethical flexibility, like when to me is vengeance seem justified right? Because when we watched like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood last year, like I wasn't asking for it, but I was okay with that ending. You know what I mean? And when we watched Hustlers, I had issues with that. You know, and what the girls and Hustlers were doing to the men. I did. And so this was another one where I got to ask myself and take an inventory and just kind of be like, okay, so like, where is, and I use that word in my head, vigilante justice, okay with me? And when is it not? And I think I'm still thinking about that. I would agree with Jay. I don't know if I'd say failed hero. She definitely wasn't a hero. A hero is something that for me, my definition is, it's like something I would want to morally and from a value standpoint aspire to. And I would not say what she was doing or what she, like, that wasn't aspirational to me. She wasn't in the beginning necessarily a villain in the sense that she wasn't committing any crimes by pretending to be drunk. Or doing anything like super ethically dicey by pretending to be drunk and then just like, you know, being like, hey, I'm sober. What are you doing? And teaching them a lesson in that by shocking them in that sense. But she did, you know, do this to many men in order to vindicate and her friend and make sure this didn't happen. But she also did have like a revenge plan in that same notebook. And that when that went into play was when she started with, not the Dean, when she started with her friend played by Allison Brie. Mm-hmm. When she started rocking that route, then things got ethically dicey.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know in the beginning when Allison Brie, when she gets her drunk and she has a man take her back to a hotel room, you don't know what she has paid that man to actually do.
Or the guy outside the lawyer's house. You don't know.
Or the fact that she kidnapped a child and took her phone in order to scare her mother, the Dean. Like, she does some crazy things. Her grief and her...
sociopath.
Yeah. you know, she is a very... she's a very grief-stricken person who has not dealt with it or been able to deal with it in a way that has freed her. She's very much a trapped individual by her own rage and her own grief still. She's very much imprisoned. And so she thinks she's liberating all, like she thinks she's constantly liberating Nina by doing all this stuff, but she's just with every move kind of imprisoning herself further and further. Mentally and emotionally, even though she thinks it's going to give her, I don't know, she's not free until she's dead. You know what I mean? It's really, I don't know. So I think that I'd agree with Jay. She's an anti-hero.
Yeah. You mentioned Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and where it's there, it's like sort of based on reality. It's also still, it's fantastical world, right? It's the Quentin Tarantino world. It's not the real world.
The fake ending. Exactly.
And that ending is the equivalent of killing Hitler as a baby, right?
Kind of like, true. Yeah.
We know what those people are about to do and it's really jacked up.
Yeah.
But I think honestly, if this similar story beats, but we make the world a little more fantastical, I bet we would have a different take on it.
I think you're right.
You know, I think we as humans are able to compartmentalize enough to go like, look, I like the Punisher. I wouldn't like the Punisher in real life, but I like him in this crazy fantasy world, you know?
Yeah.
I like Batman. I wouldn't like this dude in real life.
You know? You're like, do I really want a Batman in my city? I don't know.
Oh my God. It'd be all messed up.
It'd be real messed up. Yeah.
It'd be messed up. So I think we're able to do that. And that's why I think in most movies, we'd be like total hero, but because this is so grounded in reality, we're like, I don't know. That seems like a really alarming things to do.
Yeah, that's a good point. So what about, okay, let's talk about this. What about do we get insights in this into like rape culture and drinking culture, or both, or one or the other? What are your guys' thoughts on this?
I have thoughts.
Tell me your thoughts, Jay.
I feel like one of the terms, you know, you see out there a lot is rape culture, sexual assault culture. But what this movie, I think, is showing, right, it's a big issue on campus. It's a big issue in the military.
Yeah.
What else is a big issue there? You know, what's the root cause? And I think it's the thing that decreases people's capacity to maintain their moral and ethical standards. So I think this was a strong commentary on drinking culture. I think it's one of the, maybe, you know, I don't want to say the cause, but I think it's the big catalyst in a lot of events.
It blurs a lot of lines for a lot of people.
When it's the thing drinking that stops you from being able to be in control of the decisions you're making.
Yeah.
You know, you made the decision to put yourself there, but then, you know, so I don't know. I don't know if it gives insight to both, but to me, you know, the term rape culture, and, you know, there's studies with way smarter people than me, but to me, this is really trying to go, what are some of the catalysts? What's some of the root causes? So that's why I think this was a really interesting take, because this is about a very specific, this is about drunk dudes looking for, or maybe drinking dudes looking for just blackout, stumbling, can't find their way. You know, it's a very specific thing that it's commenting on.
Yeah. And that's an interesting point, because even like the two guys in the beginning, like they're portrayed as nice guys, you know, they're even kind of like, I'm a nice guy. So it's like with the drinking, like how much of a different person, like they're not outward, like how much of a different person are they with the drinking, and how emboldened do they feel by having their inhibitions lowered by drinking, and then now seeing like an opportunity for them to fulfill an impulse in, and it's all right, because that's a very interesting point.
I'm going to agree. But I also think it definitely gives insight into the rape culture, but the rape culture because of the drink culture, because of this. Cassie uses it to her benefit, the drinking culture, in two ways.
Mm-hmm.
She acts like she's drunk, and then she gets her friend drunk by drinking ginger ale and getting her hammered to the point where she can blackmail her,
mm-hmm,
or make her feel, you know, what Nina felt. So, because that's essentially what it is. She paid someone to take her up to a room and make it seem like something had happened. When Nina went to this friend, the name is she went to Madison, which is Allison Brie, and said, you know, trying to talk to her, and Madison just shoved her away. So, you know, Cassie uses both aspects. She uses it from how males would essentially do it, get somebody drunk, and she plays the part. But I mean, that's, you know, what I'm going to say about the insight of the rape culture is we far too often hear people say, you know, I was drunk, you know, and she said that in the film. She goes, if I, no excuse. That is zero excuse. If anything, you should be the person to want to take care of someone to make sure that they're okay, regardless if you know them or not. So yeah, that is my thought. It definitely plays into both, but I think definitely the drinking culture, because it is a means to an end. So
yeah, I would agree with both of you. I think I have a difficult time. I don't know exactly the definition of rape culture. Like, what do we describe that as? Like, help me with that.
Yeah, it's tough. I think it's a broad term. And that's why I think this movie really was so good at commentary on all these little nuances.
Yeah.
You know, the administrative, the drinking culture element, the grief, the remorse, all the different emotions, all the effects of, you know, this happened to my friend, but now my parents, you know, are feeling like just,
yeah.
I think this movie does a really good job of saying, yeah, what does this mean? What are the effects? What are the causes? And it doesn't, it's not, I don't think out there to go, it's this. I think it's to go, here's some of them. This is a complex topic with complex outcomes. You know, like on the surface level, it's not complex. But I think when you dig into it on a grand scale, it's really complex. I think this movie does a really good job of just kind of highlighting some of the complexities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, I thought it was interesting that they portrayed some of the characters, not all of them, but like, you know, you see Ryan, where it's like realizing what, like, the person he grew into would be, it was like repulsed by what he participated in 7 years prior. So there's been all this growth. And I just thought that was so fascinating of like, that's another facet and a caveat when some of these things come out, how we deal with them moving forward and how do we improve things if we're not able to ever make it okay to admit when we've done something unsavory. I'm not talking about like the actually committing the crime part, but like, you know, how do we make it okay? I don't know. Or just looking at that and now moving forward and going, okay, like with see something, say something, like, how, you know, or if you're there and you're too afraid to say something, like making it okay for people to come forth and say something and understand that they may not have the ramifications or like their life ruined in however many years, because that, I mean, it just, yeah, this movie was so complex and it did so many things so well. It's worth multiple viewings.
Well, to generalize kind of your view on Ryan, Bo Burnham's character's development. I mean, I just think about the you from 10 years ago.
No, absolutely.
I'd be like, oh my God, what a douchebag. I don't want to hang out with this guy. I would not want to be near me from 10 years ago. Like me now with four kids and like responsibilities. Like I wouldn't want to hang out with me, you know, and that's just like on a general level. Like, God, yeah. I've been so annoying. It would have driven me nuts. No way would I have liked me 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. Well, any final thoughts on this movie, on Promising Young Woman, Ryan?
I'm just going to have to agree with Jay, and this movie will definitely be one that, you know, has a lasting impact. People are going to be thinking about this movie and talking about this movie instead of a movie that made and just you kind of forget about it. This is definitely going to have some clout in the future, I believe. So it's a great movie. Check it out. It's heavy subject matter, but it is a movie that is brilliantly put together. And I will say the same thing when we talk about Nomadland. Two great movies by female directors that were pieced together brilliantly. It takes a hard topic to watch, but does so in a way that you're not really necessarily thinking about it. You're watching the story unfold.
Yeah. And I think, if nothing else, I mean, this movie is a lot to take away content wise, but it definitely Emerald Fennell should be a name that's on the lips of, cinephiles everywhere.
Yes.
For her breakout movie and to film this in 23 days and
while
to just
pregnant
while pregnant. You just, it, she's got, she's amazing. She's amazing. This film is a piece of art. It really is. So if nothing else, she should be the name on everyone's lips. Jay, what about you? Any final thoughts?
I think this movie is heavy in thought, heavy in moral conundrums, but it's handled with a deft hand. And it's fantastic. I would suggest everybody watch it, debate it in your head, think about it. I would not compare this to Nomadland for obvious reasons. This was watchable. So I hope it gets nominated for a best picture. nomination. No Man's Land sucks.
With that, we're going to wrap up this episode of Promising Young Woman. And we're going to talk about what's coming up for us. We've got fun time tornado season. Everyone loves a good storm and a good tornado. Or is that just me growing up over here? Yeah, you like a good
storm. We all live in the Midwest.
Got to watch from the front porch.
Me too. So we've got the tornado movie coming up, Twister, for its 25th anniversary. And then in the early bits of April, we're going to be covering Star Trek First Contact for its 25th anniversary as well. And we're going to have the creator and the godfather of flashbacks, Scott McFarlane, the one and only, coming back and bringing his vast Trekkie knowledge to the show. So, Jay, what else do we got going on?
For the Front Row Network, the Flashbacks team is going to be getting together for a couple full disclosures. So we're taking it over some more. We're going to break down Godzilla versus Kong, and we are all super stoked for that. And then we're going to get into the old and new Mortal Kombat movies. We're definitely not going to talk much about Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
Why not?
Maybe we'll save it for the Patreons.
Well, hey, let me talk to you about taking a dump in a bucket in a van.
In addition to all that, we have award season breathing down our neck, so expect full coverage of all that. Jay and I are going to be going 12 rounds on why Nomadland is a beautiful film and not just about pooping in a bucket. So we're going to talk about all things Oscars coming up, so be on the lookout for that. And then ending April, we'll be breaking down the 1999 Best Picture winner and winner of the last movie to win the big five, Silence of the Lambs.
It's 1991.
Sorry, 1991. Sorry, I'm allowed one slip up, okay?
Well, that was like your seventh. You said No Man's Land was good
with
six
Sally
times, so there was a slip up.
Shut up. I'm gonna wipe the floor with you for Nomadland.
Yeah. We're gonna fight about bucket poops after we get off air. And I'm gonna wrap it all up. On behalf of us here at the Front Row, and especially Flashbacks, thanks for listening, and we'll see you all in the Front Row.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more from the Front Row Network, including our articles or our other dozens of shows, visit thefrontrownetwork.com or nprillinois.org/programs/Front Row Network. You can also find us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram, and on Twitter @Front Row Reviews with a Z.